Well, that song means it's time for the Jesus Factor. I'm Scott Stevens, and I'll have a whole lot of information on Israel for you today. We're going to wrap that up. A few comments on current events. So stick around. Enjoy the show. That's right. It's time for the Jesus Factor. Good afternoon. Glad to be here today. And boy, they had a good show in the last hour. All the shows today were good. It's funny. I don't think I've ever, at least in my adult life, maybe when I was a youngster, forgot about the changing of the clock. I had thought about it earlier in the week, and it's funny. I got up, and as I usually do on Sunday, I tune into the Ministry Network after spending a few hours working to bring some of the details of the program together. And I was at least surprised to find that I had missed that altogether. And as I said, I mean, the last program was a good program, and there was a particular point that was made on that program that I thought, at least in my own walk with the Lord, and I think for everybody's, it's a critical element of things. When you finally get the importance, the goodness of God at what he's done for us in the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, that pushes everything else out of the way. We stop feeling sorry for ourselves and blaming people and God for the things and events and circumstances that we're in. And we put Jesus in the center, and we become thankful for our deliverance from a certain fire, where if we have received in fullness the word of God, we know without any deliberation that that is where we would have ended up, but for his grace and mercy and love, which he showed by his work on the cross. Most people probably realize that Israel is in the midst of a number of very serious, what appear to be small, nibbling conflicts around the edge. And today's program was going to be one where I went directly back to the time of the formation of Israel, right after the partitioning by the United Nations. During that time, there was a civil war just before Israel's declaration of statehood. And that civil war was one that Arabs in small groups warred against Israel as the march toward certain statehood for that country was underway under the British authority. Excuse me. And I was going to go right there, but because things seem to be heating up in Israel perhaps more quickly than even I might have imagined, I thought we'd take a look at what was going on there over the last week or so and compare it to another portion of Israel's history, which was the Six Days War back in the 70s. The 60s. I apologize for that. And one of the things that, for me, has been a focus of this study on Israel has been the natural determination with which the people of Israel have stood against an onslaught of both military and technological and just rhetoric, you know, the media's effort all around the world, particularly the Arab media, but of late the United States joining in with the Arabs to undermine the credibility of Israel's government and to undermine our unity as a country with Israel, to support them in their endeavors as the only country in the Middle East that we can rely on for our purposes, whatever they may be. That determination to stand in many ways is one that I'd like to think was a natural reflection of how we ought to stand in the Lord when we are confronted over and over again with the various things that come against us day to day. We so often fall short in these things. But to look at the history of Israel, beginning with the formation of the Zionist movement back in the middle 1800s, we have a successive series of generations of people that have been unwilling to compromise or give up. Everybody remembers, or most people on this broadcast listening to the broadcast today will remember, Jacob and his stand. We're going to talk a little bit about that and how Israel came to be where they are. Israel is the only solid U.S. ally in the Middle East, and most of what we've talked about in the past couple of weeks has been focused on founding of the country and how the real estate looked just before Zionism. Of course, before the end of World War I and the Balfour Declaration, which put the region under British authority, the area was controlled by the Ottoman Turks, whose empire dominated the Middle East for nearly 400 years. Beginning in the mid-1800s, Zionists laid hold of a portion of Israel by purchasing real estate from the empire and developing successful farms along with the economic infrastructure to support them under the British mandate, which was in place from 1917 through 1948. Throughout this long period, the Jews continued to develop land patiently and established communal living arrangements known as kibbutzes. They worked with the Brits to govern the area and continued to bring Jews into what we recognize today as modern Israel. This is the same geographic area that the Lord promised to give the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose name was changed, as I said earlier, in Genesis 32, to Israel, which means a prince with power over God and man. Some listeners will know that the word prince has a number of meanings in the Hebrew language from the Old Testament, and among these is minister or angel or messenger with authority. For our purposes here, it is important to realize that Israel is a people that occupies a particular place in the plan of God for this creation. The role that the people Israel and the land of Israel plays in the unfolding of the Lord's plan for all of us here is critical. The existence of Israel as a nation at the time of the end of the church age is in accordance with Scripture, particularly the revelation of John, and its becoming a nation state in 1948 is one of a number of things that point to the plan of God for this age being near its fulfillment. Our ministry here on the Jesus Factor deals with historical and biblical events in which the hand or power of God is clearly manifested and the work of that wicked to interfere with that plan is also apparent. The fall of Christianity into apostasy, along with current events in modern Israel and elsewhere in the world, suggest that this age is near its conclusion. The focus of today's show will center on the time of Israel's founding. Before we go to that, it seemed good to take a closer look at the current affairs in Israel, which may be on the verge of war. As we will see, being at war is not unusual for Israel. But until now, the wars that have been waged against the Zionist state have been what modern historians call conventional as opposed to nuclear wars. Many of you are aware that the potential for an Israeli and perhaps even an American military conflict with Iran, as that country steadily marches toward its goal of attaining nuclear weapons, is very, very clear. Certainly over the past week, Israel has taken military actions against Palestinian terror groups and begun to shore up its internal security. These are clear signals that the country is preparing for an expanded and potentially extended major conflict. yes, that is the fate of the natural man. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier today that Israel has struck a strong blow against terrorist groups in the Gaza Strip over the past several days. The Prime Minister said, "We have collected a high price from them, and we are still collecting." Netanyahu said, "We will continue to operate as long as it is necessary." Netanyahu also said that Israel remains on high alert for a terrorist attack on the Egyptian border. On Friday, the Israel Air Force launched a strike on Palestinian targets in Gaza, killing the leader of the Popular Resistance Committees, the organization that captured former IDF, that's Israeli Defense Forces, soldier Gilad Shalit. An IDF spokesman said in a statement that the attack targeted Zahir al-Qazi, the secretary general of the Popular Resistance Committees, and his collaborator, Mahmoud Hanani. Israel and Palestinian officials reported that the IDF forces fired two missiles at a vehicle in northern Gaza, immediately killing al-Qazi and Hanani, who were inside. Al-Qazi, the IDF spokesman said, was recently organizing a large coordinated terror attack out on Israel's border with Gaza. Hanani was a resident of Nablus, one of the prisoners freed as a part of the deal to release Gilad Shalit, and was expelled to the Gaza Strip. Al-Qazi was one of the masterminds of the deadly terror attack on August 2011, in which eight Israelis were killed on Highway 12, which runs along the Israeli-Egypt border. The Popular Resistance Committees responded on Friday to the attack and vowed to avenge Al-Qazi's death in a way that would, quote, shake the Zionist enemy. Hamas spokesman in the Gaza said that, in response to the attack, that Palestinian people have a right to defend themselves. Israel's contention, of course, is that this was a preemptive move. And what has been common from the founding of Israel, if not from even before under the British Mandate, Israel will not wait until an opposing force marshals and becomes able to deal them a death blow. Israel will not wait. Following the IDF strike on Friday, two mortar shells and eight rockets were fired into Israel, and cities near the Gaza border were put on high alert. The residents have been asked to stay close to bomb shelters. After the rocket fire, IDF forces proceeded to strike targets in Gaza, killing more Palestinian militants who were trying to fire rockets into Israel. Highway 12 was also closed to traffic on Friday evening. And this is a common occurrence. What would you be doing here in America if your neighbor in Canada was firing rockets over the border into your cities? Would you not be seeking a way to rub them out? And in reason and justice, seeking to deal with them to avoid having to rub them out, Israel has for decades sought to make agreements with the Palestinians, which when they are just in the process of coming to a logical and positive conclusion, terror groups begin to instigate more hostilities. This is a common tactic in revolutionary communism. One branch of an organization will claim to be negotiating while other branches continue to agitate. The goal of all of this is to paint the people who are defending themselves as the aggressor, as has been done with the help of the boobs in the modern media today. Earlier last Friday, prior to the IDF attack, two mortar bombs were fired into Israeli territory by these Palestinians. IDF officials, speaking with Army Radio following the mortar attack launched by Gaza militants, called the volley unprovoked and indicated that it was not in response to any Army operations in the coastal enclave. Late last month, Israeli aircraft bombed two targets in southern Gaza Strip overnight, targeting a smuggling tunnel in the town of Rafah on the border with Egypt and a building where Israel says militants manufactured weapons. The strikes came in response to rockets fired at southern Israel over the weekend, an army statement said. It said Palestinian militants fired more than 50 rockets and mortar shells at Israel over the past 2 months. No immediate injuries have been reported. In the address today, Netanyahu said there was no doubt that the IDF action disrupted preparations for a terrorist attack. And that is the purpose of Israel's militancy in these situations. When they become aware, as they have, that a country or group is marshaling against them, before that group can get the military edge. And usually they are made aware of these things by their intelligence organization, the Mossad. They move first. And always, in every situation after the conflict, Israel produces documents that show that they were right in their move militarily. But of course, and particularly lately, the modern press isn't interested in those documents. They're only interested in showing pictures of the poor, hapless civilians. The Palestinians that are caught in the middle of all this, they stay there and become a pawn in the hands of the Palestinian terrorists and the Palestinian government, who orchestrate these destabilizing events. And particularly now, at a time when we have this thing going on with Iran, the buildup in Iran, the continuing work in Iran towards the acquisition of nuclear weapons, which will easily be able to reach the nation of Israel. According to the IDF, more than 110 rockets have been fired at Israel from Gaza since last Friday. More than 30 rockets have been shot down by the Iron Dome, which is designated to only intercept rockets identified as heading toward populated areas. Now, this Iron Dome is an interesting installation. People may know that the United States has designed and has technologically succeeded in being able to shoot down very fast-moving rockets and missiles, targets that just 10 to 15 years ago, our technology would not have allowed us to shoot down. Well, Israel, which is their common practice, procures these highly technological weapons platforms from the United States, and then modifies them and improves them even further, making them more accurate and more reliable. On Sunday afternoon, this is earlier today, two rockets were intercepted by the Iron Dome over Beersheba. Some people will recognize that name, Beersheba, a place that we hear about in the Word all the time. Shrapnel from one of those damaged a vehicle in the center of the city. Earlier today, a volley of rockets fired from Gaza was intercepted at the Iron Dome as the escalation in Israel's south continued for a third day. And we're going to see how this parallels what happened in the time that led up to the Six Days War, and how it is not unlike the discussion that we had here on the Jesus Factor last week of the civil war, which was underway before the establishment of Israel as a nation. The tactics of the Arabs have not changed, and Israel is not going to be deceived by their efforts or feigned efforts at negotiation. Early today, the IDF conducted three strikes in Gaza in which two Palestinians, including a teenager, were killed. And this is the price that the Palestinians end up paying. They place their civilians, their women, their children, between the militaries, the terror groups, and the military of Israel. We learned about this when we first encountered it in Vietnam. Western civilizations do not do this, typically, where they use women and children as cannon fodder. But we have enemies all around the world that are more than willing to place their civilians, their women, and their children in such a way as to use them to embarrass us or nations such as Israel that are seeking to stand against this militancy. Schools were called off on Sunday in Ashkelon, Beersheba, and Ashdod. Now, we just had Bible studies about those places recently, and the group that I get together with on Thursday evening, talking about 1 Samuel over there and the loss of the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant went through these various places during that period of time in biblical history. So more than 200,000 students were out of school for those periods of time. So far in this conflict of late, 16 militants have been killed, and then this one Palestinian teenager, sadly, in this latest Gaza border violence that began last Friday. A Thai worker in the Israeli community near the Gaza border was seriously wounded in a rocket attack also on Friday. The rocket salvos from Gaza began Friday after the Israeli Air Force launched the strike in Gaza that we mentioned earlier that killed the leader of the Popular Resistance Committee, who was believed to be planning a large terror attack on Israel's southern border. On Saturday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with regional council heads in Israel's south and said Israel will continue to strike whoever plans attacks on Israel's citizens. Since the action began last week, the IDF, as of Sunday afternoon, struck 21 targets in Gaza, including 13 airstrikes to halt rocket launching attempts and 8 attacks against weapons factories and storage sites. So here you have a situation where the Palestinians are continuing to make weapons, militarize their people, agitate them against Israel. Israel continues to seek to... How long can a people be expected to tolerate this stuff within their midst? And of course, the United States says in all of this that they are deeply concerned by the renewed violence in southern Israel. U.S. State Department spokesman Victoria Nuland said in a statement Saturday, quote, "We condemn in the strongest terms the rocket fire from Gaza by terrorists into southern Israel in recent days, which has dramatically and dangerously escalated in the past day. We call on those responsible to take immediate action to stop these cowardly acts." Continuing, she says, "We regret the loss of life and injuries, and we call on both sides to make every effort to restore calm." And that is the type of rhetoric that the Jesus Factor has come to expect from the United States regarding Israel. President Obama's recent lukewarm responses to Prime Minister Netanyahu's orchestrations against the nuclear buildup in Iran make this all too common between Hillary Clinton's seemingly unshakable faith in political negotiation and sanctions to stop the Iranians from eventually blowing Israel off the face of the globe and Obama's apparent indecision as to how to deal with obvious aggression of militant Islamists. It's a wonder that war hasn't already begun. The only thing that stops evildoers of this world is the absolute certainty that it is they and not you who are going to meet Jesus if war breaks out. So what does our president do? Offer conciliatory remarks that help to assure the Iranians that the United States will not be there with Israel when the first shots are fired. This helps to encourage the enemies of Israel and make their move, and so war become unavoidable. Just pure, pathetic, tactical planning by our government. Egypt's ambassador to the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Othman, told the Palestinian Mahan news agency earlier today that Egypt was working to halt the escalation of violence between Gaza and Israel. He said his country was in contact with both sides in an attempt to stop the violence in order to avoid undesirable developments. He also called Israel's offensive unjustifiable and a breach to the truce sponsored by Egypt. And this language is just another piece of the Arabic strategy to tie Israel's hands. The Israelis recognize the need, despite all of the talk, to shore up their positions when under the threat of war. If America would send a decisive message in support of Israel, much of the Arab language would be more conciliatory because they would be afraid of the consequences of angering not only Israel, but the United States as well. From the Palestinian territories, the Popular Resistance Committees promised revenge for Qaisi's assassination. They said all options are open before the fighters to respond to this despicable crime, the assassination of a terrorist who was proven to be planning an attack on Israel. That's criminal in accordance with the thinking of the Palestinians. He said that the assassination of our chief will not end our resistance. Abu Ataya, a Palestinian resistance councilman, said, "The Palestinians are a tentacle of the Arab octopus that is seeking to hold Israel in check while the Iranians prepare their weapons for the destruction of the Zionist state. This is only a matter of time." And as we look at the Six Days War, I found it amazing that the same tactics were in place then and how very similar they were to the Arab tactics that existed just predating the establishment of Israel as a state. The Arab spokesman continued and said Israelis' escalation creates a negative atmosphere and increases tension, which leads to the increase in violence in the region. Palestinian Authority spokesman Nabu Abu Radina said. That was their spokesman, and the IDF issued a statement saying that it holds Hamas responsible for the recent incident since the terror organization currently has jurisdiction in the area. That's the Gaza Strip. And of course, Hamas has control in that area, and their governing authorities, again, feign negotiation while their military arm continues to agitate in this way. Israel said that we will continue to respond to any attack against Israel. The Hamas movement, although not the one performing the launchings, is not doing anything to prevent it either. We hold them responsible and will continue defending and attacking as necessary. It is estimated that the long-range and mid-range rockets are being launched by Islamic Jihad terrorists, while the short-range rockets are being launched by the Popular Resistance Committee, this Al-Qaisi's operation. So all of this action comes as Israel must stand, at least on the face of it, alone against a determined, orchestrated Arab military buildup and terror assaults from within the Palestinian community. We at the Jesus Factor ask that you all pray for Israel to be steadfast in their stand against the Arabs, and that the Lord would confound the efforts of Satan and his minions as they come against those that belong to him.
White horses and ladies by the score, all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man. White leaves and feathers, they made up his bed. He went to fight wars for his country and his king, of his honor and his glory. The people would sing.
Tune by a British band called Emerson, Lake, and Palmer about a guy who didn't know Jesus. I don't know if they thought that was what it was about, but that was what it was about. There you have it. No money could save him, and he laid down and died. They left out the part where not knowing Jesus ends you up in hell, but of course that was the way things were back in the 60s. It's funny, some of the music is enjoyable to listen to. It's just music. Now, back to more serious matters. Question on the chat there. I'll take a look at that. KONY2012. I'll look at that over this week and see if I can find anything out about it and bring it back to the program for next week. People in the chat have questions. I'm happy to look into them and see if we can deal with them here on the Jesus Factor. Now, before we go back to modern times, in an effort to clarify how things have gone in this particular region and how the Arabs have operated as Israel came into being and how they continue to operate today and our response to that as a nation, which in its beginning was appropriate in most cases. Nowadays, we vacillate way too often in dealing with these threats. We send mixed signals to Israel, and we send mixed signals to their enemies and to our enemies. We think that we can talk them into being nice. But that is foolishness. They cannot be persuaded to be nice by words. Only fear brings them up short. Now, what we have going on in Israel just before it's becoming a nation is a war in which organized Arab groups from Syria, what they called Transjordan at the time, groups that with names like the Army of the Holy War, similar to the radical Islamic groups that we have in and around Israel today, were orchestrating a destabilizing series of attacks that came to be thought of as the Civil War in Israel that predated the establishment of the state. The Jewish population in these times had received strict orders requiring them to hold their ground everywhere at all costs. That is always the set of orders that the Jews in Israel are under. And you know, when you think about it, when we find ourselves in a situation of unbelief, of sin and rebellion that we as natural people lived in before we knew Jesus, when we recognize as he quickens to us that place that we're in, we are in a similar situation. If we don't get our acts together and get with his program, there's only one place we can expect to land. We know this because he has enlightened our minds and quickened to us the state of our rebellion, our stubbornness, our inability by nature to do that which is good. And it's in that place, under that pressure, that we actually come to a place where we learn to trust in him. And thank God that he enables us to do that by his actions on the cross. The Jews in their steadfastness are a natural reflection, and all through the Old Testament have been a natural reflection for Christians to learn from. They are here for our good. They were told to hold their ground at all costs, even though they were under assault from 100,000 Arabs from upper and middle classes in Haifa, Jaffa, and Jerusalem. I mean, this was an all-out onslaught. Now, the situation was so destabilized that it caused the USA to withdraw their support for the partition plan, which the United Nations had enacted just in the midst of all of this. That encouraged the Arab League to believe that the Palestinian Arabs, reinforced by the Arab Liberation Army, could put an end to the plan for partition. The British, on the other hand, decided on 7th of February 1948 to support the annexation of the Arab part of Palestine by Transjordan. They were seeking to get Jordanian support for the Israeli state. And the problem at this point was that a certain level of doubt took hold among Jewish supporters. Once again, you have issues when people fail to stand. Their apparent defeats were due more to their wait-and-see policy than to weakness. David Ben-Gurion, who then was the leader of the Haganah, which was became the Jewish IDF after Israel became a nation, made conscription obligatory. Everybody, man and woman, had to receive military training. Golda Meir raised funds from sympathizers in the United States, and then Stalin decided to support the Zionist cause. The Jewish representatives of Palestine were able to sign a very important armament contract in the East. Other Haganah agents recuperated stockpiles from the Second World War, which helped to improve the army's equipment and logistics. This set the stage for Israel's unilateral declaration of statehood. Following the 1947 United Nations plan to partition Palestine, which many would say resulted in this civil war that went on for almost a year, the executive head of the World Zionist Organization, David Ben-Gurion, and the president of Jewish Agency for Palestine declared that Israel was a state independent from the British mandate and that neighboring Arab states, once that declaration was in place, invaded the next day in support of the Palestinian Arabs, even though they had signaled that they would do otherwise. And this is the danger of negotiating with people that you know want to kill you. During the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, Transjordan's Arab Legion attempted to capture the entire city of Jerusalem. Now, fortunately, as I said before, just before declaration of statehood, they had received support, conscripted all of their people into the military, made a decision to make their stand, placed their weapons, and got things in order, in spite of the fact that they were in the midst of essentially a terror attack from all sides. This is not unlike the situation that they're in presently, although on its face, this perhaps was worse. today what they have going on over there in the end with the kinds of weaponry that are out there among the Arabs and the potential for an Iranian nuclear weapon. This situation has the potential to be much worse. During this time, western portions of Jerusalem came under Israel's control only after Israeli forces broke the Arab siege of the city. In the first 4 weeks of Arab attack, 200 Jewish civilians were killed and over 1,000 were wounded in Jerusalem. But defending themselves, Israeli forces managed to capture some suburbs and villages from the Arabs. The Israeli defenders were not as successful in protecting the Jewish community of eastern Jerusalem. On May 28, 1948, the Jewish quarter of the Old City fell to the Arab Legion. After 10 months of fighting, an armistice agreement was signed on April 3, 1949, dividing Jerusalem along the November 1948 ceasefire lines of Israel and Transjordan forces, with several areas of no man's land. The armistice line served as a temporary border between what had formerly been two mixed communities. Western Jerusalem became Israel's capital city, while Eastern Jerusalem, including the holy sites, was occupied by Transjordan, which in 1949 became the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. The city was essentially divided between two armed camps separated by barbed wire, concrete walls, minefields, and bunkers. Upon its capture by the Arab Legion, the Jewish quarter of the Old City was destroyed and its residents expelled. 58 synagogues, some hundreds of years old, were destroyed, their contents looted and desecrated. Some Jewish religious sites were turned into chicken coops or animal stalls. The Jewish cemetery on the Mount of Olives, where Jews had been burying their dead for over 2,500 years, was ransacked. Graves were desecrated, thousands of tombstones were smashed and used as building material, paving stones, or for latrines in Arab Legion military camps. The Intercontinental Hotel was built on top of the cemetery, and graves were demolished to make way for a highway to the hotel. The Western Wall, that's where the Jews all go to pray, became a slum area. In 1950, Jordan annexed the territories it had occupied and captured in the 1948 war, Eastern Jerusalem and the West Bank. The April 24th resolution declared its support for complete unity between the two sides of the Jordan and their union into one state, which is the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, at whose head reigns King Abdullah ibn al-Hussein. We all remember the line of the Husseini kings over in Jordan. As time goes on, when Israel became more and more mighty, as we will see, Jordan actually became compliant with Israel. I won't say supportive, I think that would be an overstatement, but Jordan actually became compliant. And we learn through history, we learn from the Word, we should learn the many, many times that we have learned and heard that when Israel is strong, the enemies of Israel are at peace with them. When Israel is weak, the enemies of Israel are at war with them. As Americans, what that means is that when Israel is strong, we have peace. So if you, like I, am wondering why we haven't learned that and why our present administration isn't doing everything it can to shore up the strength of Israel rather than sending mixed messages that tend to tear down the strength of Israel. If you're wondering about that as much as I am, I suggest that you pray and ask the Lord to move mightily for the sake of Israel and to persuade somehow these people that are running our country to work through them in some way that will bring them to a place where they support Israel for all of our good. Now in 1950, all right, during this time when Jordan had annexed this property, Great Britain and Pakistan were the only countries that recognized Jordan's annexation. All other nations, including the Arab states, rejected it. Great Britain recognized only the annexation of the West Bank. It never recognized either Jordan or Israel's sovereignty over any sector of Jerusalem, viewing both Jordan's 1950 annexation and Israel's annexation of West Jerusalem as illegal. There was a period of time during that period where access to the holy sites by both the Christians and Jews were not allowed. And then they made arrangements in 1949 for a brief period of time under the guidance of the UN and the US. They attempted to enforce an armistice agreement, which the Jews would gain access to the Western Wall, the Jewish cemetery, and all the Eastern the sites, religious sites there in Eastern Jerusalem. The armistice lines were sealed as Jordanian snipers would perch on the walls of the old city and shoot Israelis across the lines. Unlike Jews, the Christians were allowed access to their holy sites. They, too, were subject to restrictions under Jordanian law. There were limits on the numbers of Christian pilgrims permitted into the Old City and Bethlehem during Christmas and Easter. Christian charities and religious institutions were prohibited from buying real estate in Jerusalem. Despite Israel's appeal to Jordan to stay out of the war, Jordanian forces fired artillery barrages from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Okay, all this going on. Again and again. And then, in this environment, with only Christians allowed to gain access to their sites, there came a point when Israel had had enough. And that was the point in the 1960s that history calls the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War was known as the June War. It was the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, or the Third Arab-Israeli War, with the war before Israel's becoming a nation, that civil war being the first, the war that we just described that resulted in the partitioning of Jerusalem and those lines being drawn as the second, and then this, the Six-Day War, as the Third Arab-Israeli War. The war was fought between June 5th and 10th, 1967, by Israel and the neighboring states of Egypt that were known at that time as the United Arab Republic, Jordan, and Syria. After a time, and again, pay attention, after a time of escalating rhetoric, with Arabs threatening to destroy Israel, the war began on June 5th with Israel launching surprise airstrikes against Arab forces. Okay, in a nutshell, the outcome was a swift and decisive Israeli victory. Israel took effective control of the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, the West Bank and East Jerusalem from Jordan, and the Golan Heights from Syria. You will remember, these were the places that most, many terrorist assaults before this reannexation, this recapture of these lands, and Israel, of course, justified their military action of the Six-Day War as a function of one that was defensive in nature, because Arabs were militarizing these sites and used them and their strategic advantage to continue to chip away at Israel's resolve to stand strong in that land. As usual, documents captured after the fighting by the Israelis from various Jordanian command posts revealed orders from the end of May for the Heshemite Brigade to capture Ramat Burj Bir Milan in a night raid, codenamed Operation Khalid. The aim was to establish a bridgehead, together with positions in Latrun, for an armored capture of Lod and Ramallah. The go code word was Sa'ek, and the end was Nasser. The Jordanians planned for the capture of Matza Salavim in the strategic Jerusalem corridor. Matza was tasked to Infantry Brigade 27 camp near Ma'ale Adumim, and the reserve brigade would commence a nighttime infiltration into Matza and would destroy it to the foundation and wouldn't leave a remnant or refugee from among its 800 residents. That was the Arab plan. So the plan to establish these fronts that would ultimately lead to the destruction of Israel were discovered after Israel preempted this particular operation. On the night before the war began, Egypt moved approximately 100,000 of its 160,000 troops into the Sinai, including all of its 7 divisions, 4 infantry, 2 armored and 1 mechanized, 4 independent infantry brigades and 4 independent armored brigades. Many of these were veterans of Egypt's intervention into the Yemen civil war, and the balance were reservists. These forces had 950 tanks, 1,100 APCs, and more than 1,000 artillery pieces. At the same time, 15,000 to 20,000 Egyptian troops were still fighting in Yemen. Egypt's president Nasser's uncertainty about his goals and objectives, and this is critical in this war, was reflected in his orders to the military. The general staff changed the operational plan 4 times in May 1967, each change requiring the redeployment of troops with the inevitable toll on both men and vehicles. Towards the end of May, Nasser finally forbade the general staff from proceeding with the Qahir, which means the victory in Arabic, which called for a light infantry screen in the forward fortifications with the bulk of the forces held back to conduct a massive counterattack against the main Israeli advance when identified, and ordered a forward defense of the Sinai. In the meantime, he continued to take actions intended to increase the level of mobilization in Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. So Nasser was running the show, and his confusion, looking back, seems quite clearly to be the hand of the Lord intervening for Israel's sake. Who knows how many were praying for them at that time, and who knows at which point the Lord will hear such prayers. Syria's army had a total strength of 75,000 and amassed them along the Syrian border. Jordan's army had 55,000 troops and 300 tanks along the Jordanian border. Listen to the numbers here. It's just astounding. Some of these were M48 Pattons, sizable amounts of M113 APCs, and a new battalion of mechanized infantry and a paratrooper battalion trained by the U.S.-built school, all right? These are the Israeli powers. They also had 12 battalions of artillery and 6 batteries of 88mm and 120mm mortar shells. There were 100 Iraqi tanks and an infantry division that were ready near the Jordanian border. 2 squadrons of fighter aircraft, MiG-21s, were based adjacent to the Jordanian border. On June 2nd, Jordan called up all reserve officers, and the West Bank commander met with community leaders in Ramallah to request assistance and cooperation for his troops during the war, assuring them that in 3 days we'll be in Tel Aviv. Well, we will see. Before the war, Israeli pilots and ground crews had trained extensively in rapid refitting of aircraft returning from sorties, enabling a single aircraft to sortie up to 4 times a day, as opposed to the norm in Arab air forces of 1 or 2 sorties a day. This enabled the Israeli Air Force, the IAF, to send several attack waves against Egyptian airfields on the first day of the war, overwhelming the Egyptian Air Force, and allowed it to knock out other Arab forces on the same day. This has contributed to the Arab belief that the IAF was helped by foreign air forces. Pilots were extensively schooled about their targets and were forced to memorize every single detail and rehearse the operation multiple times on dummy runways in total secrecy. This is the resolve that the Israelis had. They chose not to risk attacking the Egyptian defenses head-on and instead surprised them from unexpected directions. They had practiced driving vehicles through soft dunes in the Negev and discovered that vehicles would get greater maneuverability in desert terrain if tires were partially deflated. As a result, they could choose their angle of attack and advance through areas the Egyptians least suspected. In order to keep the performance of Israeli soldiers high in the heat of the Sinai Desert, the Israeli army ordered that soldiers be supplied with 1 liter of water every hour rather than the previous 1 liter per day. As a result, soldiers were able to perform better than their Egyptian counterparts. To prepare for war with Syria, the Mossad had sent their agent Eli Cohen to infiltrate the Syrian government, where he exploited his high-ranking position to provide crucial intelligence. Feigning sympathy for the Syrian soldiers, he ordered trees to be planted in every Syrian emplacement to shade them. These trees were later used as targeting markers by the Israelis. This is all the work of the Mossad, the most well-known and renowned intelligence organization in the world, perhaps equal to certainly MI6 and our CIA. Okay. At the end of the day, they called up the Israeli army, had a total strength of 264,000. And though this number could not be sustained, all right, they said in discipline, training, and morale and equipment, and the general competence, Nasser's army was way outgunned by the Israeli forces. Okay. It is important, okay, to remember, okay, that the main ingredient to all of this, I mean, of course, the Lord has a hand in these times and all the things that happen at the end of the day as this age draws to a climactic close. These things that took place in 1967 set the stage for the borders of Israel to be reestablished with very close to what those borders were in biblical times. At the end of the war, we have a statement here that I thought was very interesting by Yitzhak Rabin. He said, "Our airmen who struck the enemy's plane so accurately that no one in the world understands how it was done, and people seek technological explanations or secret weapons, our armored troops who beat the enemy even when their equipment was inferior to his, our soldiers in all other branches who overcame our enemy everywhere, despite the latter's superior numbers and fortifications, all these revealed not only coolness and courage in the battle, but an understanding that only their personal stand against the greatest dangers would achieve victory for their country and their families, and that if victory was not theirs, the alternative was annihilation. If we have that attitude with our desire to seek Jesus, we cannot help but be successful." We'll see you next week.